This is a Triple J podcast.
Hack. Hey, it's Dave Marchese. This is the Hack Podcast. In the years ahead, how hard do you reckon it's going to be to tell a real influencer on social media from a fake one? Because the internet's already littered with virtual personalities, and it's kind of hard to figure it out already. AI pimps are creating these personalities using pictures of real women, of course. Are our laws keeping up? And how worried should you be about your pics being used to create things like fake porn stars? Later, we're going to be diving into this world of virtual influencers and the full-blown industry that's being built up around it. Also coming up, the boss of Woolworths threatened with jail time at a fiery inquiry into supermarket pricing today. We're going to explain what went down there. First, though.
Hack. This attack will have a significant impact on the Australian community.
On Triple J.
Another intense day in Sydney, still coming to terms with the weekend's deadly shopping centre attack. This morning, news of a terrorist act. Last night, a church leader was allegedly attacked with a knife by a 16-year-old at an Assyrian Orthodox church in Sydney's southwest. It didn't end there, though. A riot targeting police, paramedics sheltering for cover, the Prime Minister calling an urgent meeting. In a bit, we're going to ask an expert what all this means for Australia's terrorism threat. But first, here's Arianna Lucente with an update.
Bring him up! Bring him up! Bring him up!
The crowd surged, we understand, from 50 to maybe 500. It was very uncontrolled for a period of time.
Our paramedics became directly under threat and was supported by police and had to retreat into the church.
It was a chaotic scene last night in a normally quiet suburb in southwest Sydney. Hundreds of people hurling projectiles at police cars and police officers and calling for a teenager who'd allegedly stabbed their bishop during a church service to be brought outside. Today, authorities used a word for the incident that hasn't been used in Australia for over a year.
We can confirm that this incident has now been declared a terrorist attack.
So, what happened? That's Assyrian Orthodox Bishop Mar Mari Emmanuel leading a service last night. It was being live-streamed. Moments later, a 16-year-old boy allegedly approached the bishop at the altar and lunged at him with a knife. The bishop suffered cuts to his head, and parish priest Father Isaac Royal was also allegedly injured by the attacker when he tried to intervene. Here's New South Wales Acting Assistant Commissioner Andrew Holland on what happened next.
The other members of the church had then apprehended the young male and held him down until the police arrived.
But police soon became aware that a large crowd was forming outside. As police and ambulance services arrived, the situation escalated.
The paramedics that served this community and the police every single day were holed up in that church for 3.5 hours.
People used what was available to them in the area, including bricks, concrete, palings, to assault police and throw missiles at police and police equipment and police vehicles.
Two police officers went to hospital, along with the alleged teenage attacker. The New South Wales Police Commissioner is Karen Webb.
We believe there are elements that are satisfied in terms of religious motivated extremism.
Just 3 months ago, the teenager was placed on a good behaviour bond after facing court for a knife crime. He was charged with offences like possessing a knife in November after an incident at a Sydney train station involving other teenage boys. At the time of last night's attack, the boy wasn't subject to any court orders or law enforcement supervision. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and the opposition leader Peter Dutton both condemned what happened.
There is no place for violence in our community. There is no place for violent extremism.
An act of violence in a place of worship is completely unacceptable in our country.
Bishop Mar Mari Emmanuel is from Sydney's Assyrian community and has tens of thousands of followers online. The community have origins in Iraq, Syria and Turkey, and there are more than 60,000 Assyrians living in Australia. Bishop Mar Mari Emmanuel is an ultra-Orthodox Christian and is known for opposing the COVID-19 lockdowns. He's also given sermons criticising the Islamic and Jewish faiths.
convened a meeting of faith leaders representing major religious organisations across Western Sydney, and their message to their communities was universal and identical, that they call for peace amongst all communities in Sydney, and most importantly, that people remain calm during this obviously distressing period.
It's the second stabbing incident in Sydney in the past 3 days, after 40-year-old Joel Couchy stabbed up to 18 people at the Westfield Bondi Junction shopping centre, which killed 6 people. Dai Lee is the federal member for Fowler, and the Assyrian Orthodox Church is in her electorate.
In light of what happened in Bondi, I think people are on the edge.
Hack on Triple J.
Arianna Lecente there. What does all this mean for the threat of terrorism in Australia? It's time to ask an expert. With us now is Dr. John Coyne, a defence strategy expert at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. G'day, John. Thanks so much for joining us on Hack.
Good afternoon.
What classes what happened in Sydney as a terrorist act, or what might authorities have used to come out with this classification? Because I guess a lot of people are asking now on the text line what the stipulations are. Many people might be asking what makes this maybe considered a terrorist act, but what happened in Bondi Junction not?
Look, these are all fantastic questions. And one of the issues here is just, we've got to remember that this isn't sort of like an absolute ruling in the ground that says, it was a terrorist attack. If you remember, there was an attack in, I believe, Haymarket, where a guy had murdered someone. He came out and tried to stab other people, and he yelled out a religious slogan, and it was not a terrorist act at all. Okay, so I guess there's early indications that there is a religious ideological component to this offence. So right up, that means that they're investigating whether or not it is a terrorism incident. But it is really early, early days. Now, we saw this also with the Weambler incident. It wasn't a terrorist incident, and it eventually was called a terrorist incident. So I caution people about sort of making an absolute judgment. And I think, the next logical question there is, we all want a decision from police and government going, hey, look, this is a terrorist incident or not. Often it takes a while to unpack this. So caution is always the best idea before declaring something a terrorist incident.
So is it unusual then for police authorities to come out so early, like just hours after something's happened, and say, oh, we do think this is terrorism?
Look, I think it's certainly unusual to do so quickly. From that perspective, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
There's a lot of talk about Australia's terrorism threat level right now. Can you take us through what it actually means? Like, how accurate are these as reflections of threats? Because right now ours is possible, isn't it?
That's right. One of the things about warnings is the longer you sit on a warning level and people go, nothing happens, people, they tend to sort of take it in their strides and get on with life, which is good in one way. So for a long period of time, the terrorist threat level in this country was probable, which meant that there was, real evidence and intelligence out there suggesting attacks could happen. It's now at possible. Now, that doesn't mean, listen to that word, and we have to be really careful with it. That doesn't mean that terrorist attacks can't happen. What it means is that there are people out there. There's no specific intelligence information about specific plots, but there are reasons to believe that terrorist attacks could occur. Now, we all have a role to play in that. So we talk about national security hotlines and things like that, but when it comes to extremism, here we're talking about families, communities. We're talking about government policy around social cohesion, as well as those more harder elements of policing and intelligence.
Do you think that, because it's a bit of a fine line, isn't it? You don't want people to be freaked out all the time, going around worried about potential terrorist attacks taking place. At the same time, you don't want them to be complacent. Where do you think we're at in Australia? Like, is it the case that maybe we've got to a stage where we're not thinking about terrorism as much because we're not hearing about it as much in the news headlines as we were, say, 9, 10 years ago?
Look, I think so. I think the words that I would say to people is that, you know, the terrorism threat is enduring. So it hasn't gone away. It's evolved and it's very different. So, you know, a decade ago we talked about terrorist groups and cells, and then we had the rise of ISIS and lone wolf actors. What we see now is a really diverse grouping of terrorism, or certainly of extremism, I should say. So by that, you know, we have, you know, we have all sorts of ideological groups. So, you know, we have white supremacists and we have incels. We have anti-authority people and we have others who, you know, who don't want immigration. And, there's a real mixture and often a hybrid of these groups.
And in terms of young people being radicalised, that's obviously a huge concern for authorities across the board. We've spoken about that a lot on Hack over the last couple of years, especially. What's the answer here? Because, I mean, there's a lot of monitoring going on online, but is there other areas that you think we should be focused on as a country?
Look, I caveat anything I say now. So I'm a 51-year-old middle-aged man. So it's been a long time since I've been a youth. So it'd be very easy for me to turn around and I can give you the great policy responses and say, you know, we need to do greater, and some of them are very true, we need to do greater moderation in terms of social media without impinging on people's freedom of speech. But we do also have to be mindful that, you know, the issue here is that in our society, and it's something that the Director General of ASIO has said in the past, which is awful but lawful. So it's not illegal to have extremist views. It's illegal to undertake terror attacks and use violence and being a violent extremist. So I guess from my perspective, that education piece is really, really important. It's about those combination of efforts. So it's not just about giving the police extra powers, but it's probably more important right now around continuing that education process for young and not so young Australians about how to critically think about the information they're receiving, both the source of it and also the information itself and its reliability. It's about families, it's about communities, it's about talking to people, it's about people understanding, it's the democracy that they live in and their ability to engage with that democracy, whether they're old or young. So I think it's all of those things, and there's a number of measures that need to be put in place.
Wow.
But education.
Well, thanks so much for coming on Hack and explaining that to us, for having a chat, Dr. John Coyne from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And we have someone on the text line saying, we don't have to love each other, but in Australia, we respect each other. I hope this madness stops. Let's all just get along.
Hack. It is open to the Senate to hold you in contempt, and that carries potential sanctions, including up to 6 months imprisonment for you.
On Triple J.
Do you ever just wish that you could sit down the boss of your regular supermarket that you go to and grill them? Why is everything so expensive? When are the prices going to go down? How can you justify this? Well, you don't have to do that because it's happening in Canberra this week and you can tune in. It's riveting stuff. Today in the Senate, the CEOs of Woolworths and Coles got up to defend their pricing and they didn't get out without a bruising. In fact, one of them got threatened with jail time for dodging questions. So what does this mean? Are our fortunes at the checkout about to change? Angus McIntosh has been looking into it.
You have not answered the question, Mr. Banducci. Honestly, I'm not interested in your spin or your bullshit. This is a Senate inquiry. Answer the question.
That's Tasmanian Greens Senator Nick McKim. And here's his target, Woolworths CEO Brad Banducci.
We measure ourselves return
very respectfully
on investment
not answering the
and
questions.
Total shareholder returns. Well, both of them around 10%.
Senator McKim was going after Coles and Woolies hard in today's Senate committee hearing into supermarket pricing. He accused Woolies of cherry-picking how it reports profits to avoid comparisons to overseas supermarkets that have reported much lower return on equity numbers. Basically, the big supermarkets are bringing in more per share than almost any other supermarkets in the developed world, and over twice what Australia's extremely profitable banks do. And when the Woolies CEO wouldn't answer the question, the senator threatened to hold him in contempt of the Senate, which could mean jail time.
The Greens make no apologies for holding the CEOs of giant corporations to account. And if that includes threatening with jail time for not answering simple questions at Senate committee inquiries, so be it.
But it's not just the Greens. Today's hearing was just the latest in a long line of jabs between politicians, farmers, and supermarkets over food prices. It's got politicians from all sides, including the government, supporting a mandatory code of conduct for Aussie supermarkets. And, in theory, Coles and Woolies are on board.
We were supportive with it being mandatory. We at Woolworths would like to set ourselves a higher bar than the code. So the higher the code is, the more it forces us to lift above that.
But those penalties aren't even written yet. And even if they are, retail experts are warning not to count on groceries getting any cheaper.
I think the inquiries will certainly detect if there's any unconscionable conduct between supermarkets and suppliers. Will it bring prices down? I don't think so.
I'm speaking to QUT Professor Gary Mortimer.
The issue is that fuel prices are high. Electricity prices are high. Wages are growing all the time. Leasing costs, operational costs, input costs are going up. And it's those input costs that keep going up that keep pressuring, putting retail prices up.
The professor's not alone in saying sky-high food prices are here to stay, and a lot of Aussies might not have a choice in where to shop, regardless of any changes to the code. When they are answering questions, Woolies and Coles point to competitors like Aldi and Costco to deflect accusations of being anti-competitive. But Senator McKim wasn't having any of it today.
There are no Aldis. In Tasmania, there are no Costcos. In Tasmania, Aldi have told this committee they've got no plans to expand in Tasmania. So what have you got to say to the people of Tasmania when you say that Australia has a very competitive supermarket sector?
Woolies says it has the same pricing all over the country, but it's still true that a lot of Aussies, especially Tasmanians and Northern Territorians, don't have much choice. A government inquiry this month supported the mandatory code, but it stopped short of pushing for powers to break up the big supermarkets. But a lot of people, including a former head of the ACCC, the Greens and the Nationals, have said the powers of that new code should go further. And Wendy Ng from Melbourne Law School reckons even that might not be enough.
I understand that there are a lot of people advocating for the power for the ACCC to force Coles and Woolies to divest stores or particular arms of their businesses. That might not be that easy. You still need to show that they have breached the competition law, for example, in some way, shape or form. And even then, the court might not be even willing to grant it because ultimately it's the court that decides what order to grant. It might be a political quick fix, but not an actual substantive quick fix in the long run.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, Angus McIntosh there with that update. If you want to hear more, read more, full breakdown on ABC News, some killer quotes in there, worth a read. We'll try to keep you across any of the big developments in this inquiry. Time to move on though.
Hack.
You've taken someone's likeness and body without their consent.
On Triple J.
When you upload a pic or video of yourself on your socials, you might be thinking a few things. Am I actually as hot as I think I am here? How many likes is this going to get? Is my ex going to regret everything when they see it? You're probably not thinking, though, this pic might be ripped and used to create an entirely fake person selling porn. But that's happening. There's a whole industry out there of AI pimps, and they're targeting high-profile models and influencers, as well as just regular women, including teenagers. And experts say what they're doing is absolutely reprehensible and not legal. Kevin Nguyen has this investigation.
If you're just glancing quickly, these reels look like content from any other model. Beautiful women dancing, showing off new outfits, hanging out with other influencers. But the thing is, they're not real women. They're AI-generated influencers made from content taken from actual women's profiles without their consent. We've traced three of the big virtual influencers back to a guy in Adelaide. He's using these profiles to help sell porn. Welcome to the world of AI pimps. This is a video that high-profile Australian model Ella Saverto posted on her Instagram account, which has 1.4 million followers. It was then taken by that guy in Adelaide who put an AI-generated model's face on Ella's body and then uploaded it to the account for one of his fake influencers, Sarah Jordan. Sarah's account, which has been deleted in the last couple of weeks, had 600,000 followers and promoted links to porn subscription websites. Ella's videos were also repeatedly lifted by the creator of one of the most famous and profitable fake influencers, Emily Pellegrini. The Emily account reportedly makes its creator more than $10,000 a month.
Get a real job, you know, stop making money off our bodies.
Australian model Robin Lawley has had her likeness manipulated many times. Her name is searchable on these AI apps where you can ask to generate an image of pretty much anything and it'll pump something out for you. And even though this industry is still relatively new, she's already sick and tired of it.
That's my problem, that, you know, they're making money from women's images and they're not, it's not their body, it's not their face, and how dare they?
She's urging the Australian government to do something about it.
My bare minimum was to get it labelled, like to get all AI images labelled minimum, you know, but then also I feel like we should have the rights to fight for our images. Say if a company wants to use your image digitally, give the right to the model to be able to give that your image, you know, so the company's not stealing your image. The model has the right to give it if they want and get paid like they should be.
This industry is huge. There's a whole corner of YouTube dedicated to video tutorials that have millions of views that teach you how to take women's photos and videos and then build your own fake influencer.
Today, we are going to create hyper-realistic AI influencers. We are even going to create stunning AI influencer videos.
One video that has more than 4 million views tells you how to get around unwanted safety layers on AI image apps that would normally stop you from generating nudes or racist content.
Good enough to trick sad, lonely men.
Remember how I said earlier that we managed to trace three of these influencers back to a guy in Adelaide? His name is Antonio Alvaro. He's responsible for the fake influencer Sarah Jordan that I told you about earlier, who's one of the world's most recognisable synthetic faces. We called Alvaro, but he didn't really want to speak to us. The morning after we contacted him, he deleted his accounts. His lawyer said he wouldn't be responding to questions. Almost none of the women we reached out to about their content being used by AI creators were aware it was happening. One knew, but she told us there was nothing she could do about it.
Look, my first considered legal opinion, having looked at that, is ick.
Kimberly Weatherall is a law professor at the University of Sydney and an intellectual property expert. She says using someone's image to generate an AI influencer is clearly a breach of copyright law. And if that fake influencer is then using that to promote porn, its creator might have to fork out more in damages.
It adds an extra element to the infringement. If you were analysing this from a copyright perspective, it would be grounds, for example, for additional damages, potentially for the kind of the flagrancy of the infringement and the moral harm that's occurred to the owner of the film.
But even if it was legal, she reckons it's still messed up.
I mean, it really is clearly reprehensible to use someone's image like that. I mean, for one thing, you're using the film that someone else has put work and effort into creating. But the other thing is, I mean, you're actually using someone's, someone's body, someone's, like many of the features of someone's face. And, you know, that's taking something, not just their film, but something very personal to them. So it just feels wrong.
Hack on Triple J.
Kevin Ewan with that story with Michael Workman, production by Ellie Grounds. Want to get into this topic a bit more now. Nicola Henry is a professor at RMIT. She researches technology-facilitated abuse, and she is with us. G'day, Nicola. Thanks for coming on Hack.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
How worried do you think we should be about this world of fake influencers? Like, are we getting to a point now where we're not going to know who's real and who's not online?
It certainly is a challenge. While generative AI can be used in fun and creative ways, unfortunately, when images are created using other people's faces, like real people's faces and real people's bodies, that's when the harm can be caused.
Yeah, and is there a bit of a grey area in all of this? Like the story that we just heard talking about what are effectively these AI pimps using people's faces to create new influencers, fake influencers, and that doesn't necessarily translate to being deepfake porn.
No, I mean, some of these images aren't necessarily sexual. They might be sexualized in the sense that often they're showing fake AI models, so entirely fake people who might have cleavage showing, but they're not always sexual in the sense of like depicting a sexual act. It's important to kind of think about the distinctions here. We do have, for instance, deep fake abuse where someone's face or their body is depicted, showing them engaged in a sexual act or nude or semi-nude. And then, of course, we have this other issue, which does kind of introduce some grey issues, particularly, and I know we'll speak about this, in relation to the laws. You know, someone could be completely clothed and their body, they could be dancing or they could be doing something, and then a porn star, their face is superimposed on that person's body. And so that might not constitute, under the law, an intimate image or a sexual image, but it can create real harm. And the harm could be theft of someone's likeness. So the data sets are trained on real people's faces and real people's bodies. So even something that's entirely fake, but then when it's, you know, it's someone's likeness, then you do have some kind of harms because there can be misrepresentations. There can also be issues around child sexual content, so child sexual abuse content. For police investigators, it can be very difficult to determine what is real and what is child sexual abuse material of an entirely fictional person.
Do you think our laws are keeping up with these developments and trends that we're seeing online at the moment?
No, not really. But look, in Australia, we have, under all states and territories, with the exception of Tasmania, there are specific criminal penalties for the non-consensual taking, sharing, or threats to share intimate images. And there's also federal criminal offences for the same. Now, all of those laws, again, except Tasmania, because it doesn't have a specific image-based abuse law, in all those other states and territories, an intimate image is defined to also include digitally altered images that depict a person's private parts or a person engaged in a private act. That could actually be prosecuted under Australian law. But there's one kind of tricky thing here is that in terms of just creating so-called deep fake images, that's not a criminal offence anywhere in Australia, except in Victoria.
What can people do to protect themselves online? Is there anything you can do, or is it just a luck of the draw thing? If someone targets you, you have to deal with it at that time.
We've already spoken a little bit about the laws, but there's also the Australian Online Safety Act, which is a federal civil remedy scheme. And essentially, the Australian eSafety Commissioner can issue warnings and removal notices to individual users as well as technology companies. They can also issue hefty civil penalties for failure to remove content. The eSafety Commissioner can also work on behalf of victims to get those images taken down from those sites. There's also other civil laws like copyright action. But there are other things. I'm not sure if your listeners will be aware, but there's some interesting digital hashing tools that have been introduced. So if you've got the video or the photo of yourself that you do not want shared, you can actually use a tool called Stop NCII, and that stands for Stop Non-Consensual Intimate Images. Essentially, you don't have to upload your photo or your video anywhere. It can stay on your machine or your device. But basically, when you use this tool, you can create a digital hash, and that digital hash can be then sent to participating organisations or part of the scheme. Pornhub, OnlyFans, Instagram, anyone attempts to upload that image on any of those platforms that are participating in the scheme, it'll be automatically blocked.
That hashing stuff is so interesting. Definitely just learn a lot then. I'm sure a lot of other people did too. Nicola Henry from RMIT, thank you for joining us on Hack.
Thank you so much.
Hack on Triple J.
And that's all we've got time for on the Hack podcast for now. I'll catch you next time. Hack.